Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with our interesting callers, some interesting topics to talk over.
Yes, we're going to talk about whether or not cold weather really causes heart attacks. There's always been lots of discussion about that. We'll have some new data that I think will shed light on this question. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about anxiety in a child's life, the recent horror that occurred in Connecticut, and how does that affect children, and what do we do about it?
Yeah. Coming up later, what's our recipe?
Yes, we've got a wonderful recipe, pumpkin ricotta cheesecake, great for this time of year. I guarantee that you will love it.
Our first caller is in Franklin, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Tom and Dr. Pastor. I get a split lip probably every year, the same place, and I was just wondering if there's anything to prevent it, or since I never remember to prevent it, to treat it.
Hmm. Now, does this happen, as it does with me, mostly in the winter or all year long?
I think it usually happens in the fall. Mm-hmm. Normally, it heals itself pretty quickly. But then this particular episode has just been dragging on for several months.
And can you tag it to anything, biting your lip or anything in particular? Just happens.
Of course not. I'm a guy. We don't pay attention.
Yeah, right.
That's right. That's right. We guys don't pay attention to silly things like that. That's exactly it. Well, split lips really come because they're winter times, because in the north and also in the south, it's drier. There's not as much moisture in the air. If you're south in Louisiana or Mississippi, it's going to be different where it's generally more humid. But split lips are really a problem from that. In cold weather, you go outside, the wind is cold. And so, one of the things you want to do is protect your lips. So do you use any lip balm at all right now?
I use chapstick or Aquaphor.
What sort of job do you have? Are you outside or inside?
I'm in sales. I'm in and out of the car all day long.
Okay. Have you ever used any over-the-counter hydrocortisone-type creams on your lip?
No.
Okay. Okay. So I've got a few suggestions. And by the way, just one more question. This does not occur in the summertime mostly. Is that correct or not?
I don't think so. I wonder if a lot of sun exposure might also affect it. I go to Arizona at the end of October every year.
Mm-hmm. Well, sun exposure can do it, and that's why I was asking about your job. So one of the things, you go to Arizona. What do you go to Arizona in October for?
I umpire a baseball tournament all week long.
Oh. Tom's eyes are absolutely ecstatic. That sounds like a very neat thing. Sun damage can be one of the things that will do it. So a couple of suggestions. First of all, when you go to Arizona, what you want to do is get a lip balm with an SPF factor in there of 15 or above. So you want to make sure that you protect your lips from sun damage when you're out in the Arizona sun. You're probably not doing it or thinking about it. I assume that. And frankly, that will make a difference. Number two, using moisturizing, product on that, such as chapstick or Aquaphor, Carmex, any one of the other things. The reasons why they sell well in the winter is our lips are drier in the winter. They're really a big winter issue. Over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream, which is 0.5%, can make a difference. It is extremely gentle. And if that doesn't work, I'd call your doc and I would use 1.5% or 2.5%, which is even better, hydrocortisone cream. And that's a prescription product. And that can make a difference. That can really sort of heal your lip. And as soon as it gets better, you stop the medicated hydrocortisone cream and you go back to the lip balm and things of that nature. But I think part of it is when you go to Arizona and you're in that sun, it's probably just setting you off. How many years have you been doing that?
Well, I've played for over 40 years, and now I've been umpiring for about the past 13.
How do you take all of the epithets that are sent to you where people say, hey, what are you doing? How do you take that?
Well, it's real simple. You realize you're not going to please but half the people half the time.
I love it. Half the people half the time. Sounds like a Lincoln quote. Thank you very much. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Yep.
Bye-bye. 1-800-462-7413.
I didn't think it'd say you can't fool all of the people all of the time, but I don't remember the beginning part of it.
All of the people some of the time, some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people
all of the time. There it is.
Okay. 800-462-7413 to a listener in Columbus, Ohio. We go now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Dr. Pastor, how are you?
Fine. Good. What's up?
Well, I have been having episodes of itchy skin with no rash. And this only occurs on my left forearm in the elbow area. And when I went to my doctor, he thought it was stress because I'm a nurse and work in a high-stress environment, and gave me like a steroid dose pack, which sort of helped, but it even woke me up before I, you know, get up. Mm-hmm. Ice seems to be the only thing that helps because that seems to numb those nerve endings.
So so the itchiness is the thing that bothers you? Is that, so you put ice on it all day?
Well, whenever it occurs, yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, you've been at your job for how long?
I've been a surgical nurse for about 20 years.
That's right. That's right. And you've only been itching for how long?
Oh, the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years.
5 or 6 years on and off. So I don't know if stress is really part of it. It's very hard with skin problems to sometimes figure out if it's a chicken and egg thing. Does the stress cause the skin problem, or is the skin problem making life more stressful? Certainly a surgical nurse is a stressful occupation. If you've been doing it for 20-odd years, you obviously like the energy in that. Right.
Okay.
That's exactly it. Change of soaps recently? Have you changed your soap at all?
No. Well, yes, I did. I when it started to happen more, I switched to like a store brand of Aveeno liquid soap.
Oh, good, good, good. Aveeno is good. It's a soap that is very, very gentle. It's tends to be much, much less drying than any of the other soaps. It's hygienic. It doesn't have perfume in it, so that was definitely a good choice. Have you put any creams on it, any steroid creams on it?
No steroid creams, but I originally would start and get just so bothersome, I tried like a 2% Xylocaine, but it almost doesn't feel like it's the skin. It almost feels like the itching is coming from within.
Uh-huh. So you didn't see anything on top of it at all?
No. Uh-huh. No bumps, no lumps. The only marks are from my constant itching.
Any injury to it at all?
No.
Okay, so you've never injured. Sometimes we get into a habit of scratching or touching certain areas. We wonder, you know, there's a little bit of an irritation, and then we cause more irritation, almost like it's our animal instinct, because dogs do it all the time. I have a suggestion of how to sort of get a full court press for a couple of weeks to see if you can get rid of the itching, and therefore it'll calm down. I'd recommend Benadryl at bedtime. That's an antihistamine over-the-counter, 25 to 50 milligrams, so you don't itch when you're sleeping. Big issue because, you know, we spend 6 to 8 hours a day in bed. And if you're itching when you're sleeping, that's going to make things worse. In the daytime, I'd recommend 2 Claritin in the morning, over-the-counter Claritin. Once again, it'll help with the itching, but double the strength on the bottle makes a big difference. Or go to Allegra or Zyrtec, which are, I think, a little bit stronger in the daytime. That's what I would do. The second thing I would do is I would call up your doc, and I would get a steroid cream, and I'd put it in there 3 times a day. And I'd use triamcinolone, but it's abbreviated TMC cream, 0.1%. And I get a small tube, and I just rub it in 3 or 4 times a day. It may not feel like it's in the skin, but it still may make a difference to the irritation in the skin. And I would try those things, and if they seem to be working, I'd stay on them for a month. And then I would slowly stop them one after another. I'd stop the cream. I'd stop the Claritin during the daytime. I'd stop the Benadryl at bedtime and see what happens. I think that you may have started with an irritation, and then you may just be irritating it on top of it, especially if it's going on for 4 or 5 years.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Take care.
You too.
Yeah, good
luck.
You know,
the problem with skin itching or beneath the skin is that it can become so irritating, and then we just keep on, you know, looking to see, is it still there? Is it still there?
That's a long time for itching in one place.
Absolutely. But we all have, they're not ticks, but they're habits in our body, and sometimes we just get into a habit of looking to see if a bump or something is still there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if we just get rid of all the sensation in the area, that can make a difference.
Well, Zorba, let's talk about winter heart attacks. You say there's some new research which might suggest they're not caused by cold?
Well, first of all, we know that angina and heart attacks, and this is really, I think, a very established thing that I've assumed, is you go outside in cold weather, all of a sudden you have a blast of cold weather, you've got heart disease, it causes vasoconstriction within the body, it can cause angina, and you can have a heart attack from blasts of cold weather. Yeah. This is what I've learned in medical school. We we've talked about it. We said cover your face. You may get angina in the wintertime. And just be careful when you go outside.
So what's this now?
Well, this is a study that looked at – first of all, we know – the other thing we know is there are more heart attacks in the winter and there are fewer in the summer. Mm-hmm. So if cold weather were indeed – causing heart attacks, you'd expect that there would be more heart attacks in places like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Yeah.
And you'd expect fewer heart attacks in Texas, Arizona, Georgia, and Los Angeles. Yeah. It would just make sense. Well, it turns out it's not the case statistically. Well, there are not more heart attacks in colder climates than there are in warmer climates. There are more heart attacks in the winter in the north and in the south, in the east and in the west, and there are fewer heart attacks in the summer.
Explain this, if you will.
Well, we don't know the answer to that. And there's some people who wonder, is it the vitamin D level? Is it the fact that it's just darker and so we're inside more? Is it, you know, is that stressful? Is winter a stressful time? And so there is an 18% increase in deaths in the winter from heart attacks than there is in the summer. 10% decrease in the summertime. Spring seems to sort of be your neutral thing. But it's not that they're more in northern climates than southern climates. They're more in all the climates.
So counterintuitive. It just makes no sense whatsoever.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, what you're saying is that if I stay here in Wisconsin in the winter, get out there and shovel snow, after not having done a whole lot of exercise, I'm not any more likely to have a heart attack than if I'm sitting on a beach chair in St. Martin.
It is counterintuitive. Yeah, St. Martin, your favorite place. Well, St. Martin wasn't in the statistical issue here because it was only the United States. So let's get St. Martin.
But what's going on here?
That's right. Well, first of all, shoveling snow, if you have angina, if you have heart disease, is not a good idea if you're out of shape. So there are a certain number of people who get out there and shovel snow, and those people die from shoveling snow. And there must be people who die in the South who do other things that they shouldn't be doing that are not shoveling snow. But statistically, there's no difference in northern climates versus southern climates. So there's something wrong with our picture about this.
Getting up from the chair and turning on the air conditioner just isn't that stressful.
Yeah,
I can't picture getting a heart attack.
That's right. Obviously, it's stressful if you're in the South getting up out of the chair. But once again, the Caribbean was not included in this, so we can't say that that's part of it.
Okay. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, and we welcome a listener in Carbondale, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, Zorba. Hi, Tom.
How can we help?
Well, I've been driven to call you by a scar on my back that just constantly itches, and it seems to be getting worse as it gets older. And I have several other scars, but this particular one is driving me crazy.
How'd you get the scar?
Well, I actually had a lipoma on my back that was about 4 inches long, and they removed it. And what makes me suspicious is that it immediately turned into a hematoma. Am I saying that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this huge hematoma about the size of a baseball after they removed the lipoma, and it took about 6 months to go away.
Mm-hmm. When was this taken off?
It's been about 12 years ago.
12 years. Wow. So that gives enough healing time. I think after 12 years, it's going to heal. You can see the scar from the outside, right?
Yes. It's only about 4 inches long.
Uh-huh. Where is it located?
It's on my lower back, like almost across the spine.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty good size scar. What do you put on it?
I've put cortisone cream, and I've tried over the years. I've been to two different dermatologists and shown my doctors, and you know they suggest different creams, but I would like to find something to make it permanently stop itching.
So you've tried everything, and it has failed. It's driving you nuts, right, after 12 years?
Yes. I mean, I'm constantly scratching. I try not to.
You try not to, but all of a sudden it's there. And undoubtedly, this is the scar that's formed that somehow is just sort of causing the irritation of the nerves there that then causes scratching. Have you tried capsaicin cream, which is red pepper cream? Capsaicin comes from hot peppers.
I have not tried it. I have taken the tablets.
I've got a couple of suggestions of what you can do. Number one, capsaicin cream. It reduces something called substance P, which is in the nerve endings, and for some people it really works for scars that itch. It'll take about a month or 6 weeks to do it. You've got to be very careful when you put it on. If you put it on with your fingers and the cream gets under the nail, as it will probably do, and you scratch your eyes, you will be an unhappy camper because you will now have red pepper cream in your eyes. That's right. Or put on a plastic glove and then throw away the glove. You have to be really careful using the stuff because that's exactly what's going to happen. And take it from me. I've worked with hot peppers and then scratched my eyes, and I am really careful when I'm around hot peppers. But I would try red pepper cream and see what that does. Yeah, question number two, have you tried the Lidoderm patch on it at all?
No, I have not.
Okay. It's lidocaine, which is what we use to numb the skin, and it's a patch. And the Lidoderm patch has a sort of glue in it, and it's the glue and the patch itself has lidocaine. It's only approved for herpes simplex, post-herpetic neuralgia scars, itching and pain in there, but it's used off-label for a whole bunch of things, from back pain to scar tissue. You take it on. It says on for 12 hours, off for 12 hours. If the glue doesn't bother you, just take it on, take it off every morning, put the patch back on. And for some people, the patch works wonders. And again, it may take 4 to 6 weeks. It's a pretty big patch, but you cut a little square out and use it. And that's a prescription patch. So those would be the two things I would try.
Okay. And do you think those would be solutions that might end this, or they're temporary relief?
I am not a soothsayer.
Because I actually had this one wild idea that maybe like plastic surgery or something would remove what's irritating me.
Not necessarily. So I think if you could get it under control with the cream or the patch, you might be much better. And it might be that once you get these things to settle down, that may make a difference. But I think you would have to consult the Oracle at Delphi to see whether or not this will completely go away.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your call.
I appreciate your advice, and I will try it.
Yeah, thanks a lot. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Mary, who needs your help with some bedwetting woes. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, my grandson is 11 years old and still wets his bed at night. He sleeps very soundly, and his parents think that this is the cause. Is this true? And do you have any advice for how to help him? Thank you."
Absolutely, absolutely. And sleeping soundly, there certainly is a sleep disturbance with bedwetting. We know that's the issue, but it doesn't really explain what it is because a lot of kids sleep soundly and don't wet their beds. Mm-hmm. So first things first, it goes away over time. There are very, very, very few adults who still wet their bed. Boys are much more likely than girls, mm-hmm. and every boy, if you look at as they get older and older and older, they're less likely to wet their beds. There's an old-fashioned remedy called imipramine. Imipramine is an antidepressant, and in a very small dose of 5 to 10 milligrams a day, a pill that's taken can often make a difference in a child for wetting their beds or not. But it's a pill. You know, you have to take it. It's an antidepressant. Works really well, especially for kids when they want to do sleepovers. Mm. Then there's another medication called, the initials are DDAVP. D as in David, D as in David, A as in Apple, V as in Victor, P as in Paul. How'd you like the way I said that?
No. What does that stand for?
Well, I don't have that on my fingertips. But it's basically an antidiuretic hormone. Okay. And what it does is there are drops that go in your nose, and they reduce the amount of urine that is produced in the evening time.
Oh.
And it is very successful. Comes in drops, comes in a spray. It's very successful, can be very, very, very much used, and I highly recommend it. We used to do bed alarms. That was a very common way before we had the DDAVP.
Well, go off if you started.
They would go off, and they would go off as soon as you would start to urinate so that it would wake up the child. And the idea was that you would then develop a methodology where the child would wake up when they had the sensation. And the bed alarms really have not been great. They've been used for a number of years. They're just not that successful. So I recommend there are things that can be done, like I said, the DDAVP or the imipramine. Do not give up hope because the child, as an adult, will grow out of it.
Lots of good information for that concerned grandmother. If you have a question for Zorba, just send your thoughts along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
You'll want to stick around. Our recipe is coming up. Lots more of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster and some more interesting research to talk over. Great things for you, so hang around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time. And Zorba, this week we have a special guest author joining us. Marisa Churchill is the author of the new book Sweet and Skinny, which features healthy versions of classic desserts. Marisa has cooked her whole life with her great grandmother, went to school to be a chef, was on Top Chef Season 2, appears on Food Network Challenges. I am so happy to welcome you, Marisa. Now, how did you happen to come up with the pumpkin ricotta cheesecake recipe?
Well, you know, it's from the holiday section of my cookbook, and, you know, holidays are one of the toughest times of the year for us to stick to our healthy eating habits, as I'm sure you know. So I was really inspired to try and give people some alternatives that they could make, whether it's for Thanksgiving or Christmas time. So that was kind of the inspiration for the pumpkin ricotta cheesecake that's topped with pecans and pomegranate seeds, which, of course, pomegranate seeds are very good for us. They have all sorts of cancer-fighting properties. And it's really using simple techniques. I mean, this is something that I think is so important. You know, we don't want to have to be searching for ingredients, and we don't want recipes that take all day to make.
You know, I find it quite interesting when I look at it. I happen to love cheesecake, and I make a New York cheesecake. And my every time I make a New York cheesecake, the first thing my wife Penny says is, "Get this out of the house."
She says she's gaining 5 pounds just looking at it, right?
No, that's exactly it. And I happen to love cheesecake, and I make it. And every time I eat it, I go, well, this is really wonderful. But I look at all the ingredients in the cheesecake. And your book, Sweet and Skinny, is really looking at how to make good recipes and with fewer calories.
Exactly. You know, if you cut down the fat and calories in a dessert by 25 to 50%, and you do it properly, you should not be missing anything with the flavor, which is very important. But if you start eating these slightly reduced calorie desserts, over a period of time, you're going to save a significant number of calories.
Right.
And that's
going
to add up to big savings, and it's going to show on your waistline.
So we're going to go through just the recipe. I know that you also have a graham cracker crust that you make that's special, and we'll put that on the website. Okay, so we start out with nonstick cooking spray, always a good way to cut down on any calories that are in there.
The
dough for one shortbread cookie crust or the graham cracker crust, like we said, we'll talk about that. So 8 ounces of reduced fat cream cheese. So this is reduced fat, not no fat. Is that correct?
Exactly, okay. You know, we don't want to sacrifice the flavor. There's also a lot of fillers in the no-fat cream cheese. But the reduced fat, you know, you've got great texture. You're still cutting back on the fat and calories. So I really like the reduced fat cream cheese.
Excellent. 1 cup of sugar we'll put down.
But if you don't want to have sugar, you can make this recipe using all stevia instead. So if somebody in the family is diabetic, they'll not only save some extra calories that way, but they'll actually be able to eat the dessert.
And that's the equivalent. We have to look at the equivalent of how many packets it is.
It would be 5 tablespoons and 1 teaspoon, because stevia is twice as sweet as sugar. So you would only use 5 tablespoons and 1 teaspoon of stevia for this recipe.
And I think a lot of our listeners are starting to use more and more stevia, which is a natural product, not manufactured, a true natural product.
Yes.
2 large eggs at room temperature. As we said, 1/2 cup of non-fat sour cream at room temperature, and you said it can also be non-fat Greek yogurt if they want to. 2 large egg whites at room temperature. A teaspoon of pure vanilla extract. Do not use artificial vanilla. It's never very good at all. Never the same thing. Worth the price difference. Two-thirds of a cup of canned pumpkin. And I think the important thing here, when you shop for canned pumpkin, make sure it says canned pumpkin. Because some say pumpkin for pumpkin pie, and they already have sweeteners in it. So when you go to the grocery store, I think that's really an important thing.
That is very important. I'm glad you noted that, because I actually made that mistake once, and it wasn't until I got home and opened the can and said, what on earth is going on? And looked at it and went, oh, that's why.
I did the same thing, and one of my favorite soups that I make for my family and my kids is pumpkin soup. And when I took it out, I made the pumpkin soup. I hadn't read the label. And then I tasted it, and I said, oh, my God, this is not pumpkin soup. What is in here? And then I went back to the can and realized my mistake. A half teaspoon of ground cinnamon, ground nutmeg, and ground ginger. A quarter teaspoon of salt. Eighth teaspoon of cloves. A cup of reduced fat ricotta cheese. 1 cup plus 2 tablespoonfuls. Very important that it's reduced fat, always.
Yeah.
2 tablespoons of large pecan pieces toasted for garnish. So you toast it. You put it in an oven. How hot is the oven you put it in?
Oven at 350 degrees for about 5 minutes until the nuts become golden on the inside and are fragrant.
Okay. And 2 tablespoonfuls of pomegranate seeds for garnish. Okay. Let's make the recipe. So preheat the oven at 325 with a rack in the lower third of the oven. Then coat a 9-inch springform cake pan with the nonfat spray. Press the crust firmly into the bottom of the pan. Set it aside. Then use an electric mixer to beat the cream cheese and sugar on medium speed for 2 to 3 minutes until it's completely smooth. Add the sour cream, eggs, egg whites, vanilla mix for 2 to 3 minutes or longer. Scrape down the side of the bowl. Then add the pumpkin, cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, salt, and cloves for another minute. Add the ricotta mix just until it's incorporated. Then pour the batter over the crust. Bake for 50 or 60 minutes until the cheesecake jiggles slightly in the center when it's shaken, and then transfer to a wire rack. Let it cool for an hour and take it out. Looks great.
Yeah.
Looks absolutely wonderful.
You know, it's a simple recipe, and the great thing about it, too, is cheesecake, it's really best to make it the day before and let it, you know, set up, get nice and cold in the oven. So it's something that you don't have to worry about, you know, racing around on, you know, Christmas Day trying to, you know, make the dessert. You can make it the day before.
I love it. It's a great idea. And as I said, on our website, we're also going to put down your yummy special graham cracker crust recipe. So
yes. And it's all sweet and skinny, so you don't even have to feel guilty about eating it.
Yes. Well, the reduction of guilt during holiday season is great. Thank you so, so much for giving us this recipe. We really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Take care.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
To get a copy of today's recipe or find out more about Marisa Churchill's latest book, Sweet and Skinny, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I have an ongoing issue. It's become almost unavoidable. Whenever I'm trying to work out, I've been trying to do another series of P90X, which I've become addicted to. But it seems like about a month into it, regardless of what I do, and I've tried to be real careful of my body mechanics, I seem to do something that jacks up my SI, and then I am down for the count, and it does this bizarre domino effect, which will work its way up my spine, hit a rhomboid, hit my neck, and it seems like so far the only thing that gives relief to it, which I hate, is tramadol, and I do not like taking that stuff. So I was wondering if there was a different way to get around it, because I don't like the side effects.
What's that P90X thing you mentioned?
P90X?
Yeah.
It's a pretty intense muscle confusion routine that's been around on CDs for, good Lord, 10 years now, I guess, Tony Horton. And it rocks. It's amazing, man. You'll be carved out of wood when you're done with it, but hey, you got to get through it. And
What's involved in this? Is it weightlifting stuff or what?
Wow. Every day is slightly different. They'll work on different body parts, and a lot of it is, I mean, they might have like some dumbbells, but a lot of it is just your own body.
it's using your body, basically using the weight of your body and the muscles of your body to work out. So first of all, tramadol, good drug, tolerated by people. It on the other hand, all drugs have side effects. And full disclosure, for years ago, I did some research at my office on tramadol, and I think it has a place within pills and analgesics. It's not quite as strong as hydrocodone. It's not quite like an anti-inflammatory. On the other hand, it has side effects. A lot of people have inebriation because it's a very weak narcotic, and it's a very weak antidepressant. So there's side effects in these drugs, and we want to use them when they work, and we don't want to use them if we can do it naturally. But I think so going back to the issues that are involved, you have to find out what exercise it is that's keying you off. In other words, that's the real trick. Now, for some people, it's a specific exercise, or it's the way you're doing the exercise. And for some people, it's the intensity of the exercise. So I'll give you a perfect example. My left knee creaks and makes sounds. It does not hurt. It does not hurt. I go to a personal trainer, and if I do a squat at a certain level, my knee will hurt for a few days. And if I do a squat that's slightly different in the way I place my foot, literally the way I place my foot, if it's 5 degrees in a different direction, I don't have any pain at all. And I am always shocked at the difference of this, that if I do it slightly wrong, I hurt. And if I do it right, I don't hurt at all. So what you need is to figure out what exercise you're doing wrong, because you're doing something wrong. If you're down on the count for your sacroiliac joint, that is not a good sign. That's number one. Number two is sometimes a physical therapist will give you exercises, and a good trainer can do the same, that will just relax that joint, and that might be the other issue. And generally, exercises that work on the piriformis can make a big difference for that. And I'll put some piriformis exercises on our website, zorbapastor.org, and I'll put down a couple of exercises that I think are really good for this.
Cool.
So how many days a week do you exercise?
When I'm doing the routine, uh-huh. 7.
7 days. And how long do you exercise? How long is the routine time-wise?
Hour to an hour and a half.
Hour and a half. Okay. So what you want to do, since they're different exercises on different days, is you want to key in is what is it that's doing it? Is it length of time? And then if you can't solve the problem, you either want to go to a trainer or a PT, and they'll look at it and they'll help you. But I'll put some piriformis stretches that may help your SI joint, and we'll put it on our website.
Sweet.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the call. And before we take a short break, Zorba, let's see if one of our listeners can successfully stump the doc. Today's medical mystery comes to us from a chef named Marina. And I'll be honest, this one sounds like a real nightmare. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I dream too much, and my dreams are exhausting. At night, I'm either at work, slicing, grilling, and stirring, running marathons, bungee jumping, or fighting pirates. By the time I wake up, I'm ready for a nap. I have no problem falling asleep, and I'm not stressed. I eat lightly at night and avoid caffeine and sugar. I even tried a little brandy before going to bed, but nothing brings me peace. Rarely, I'll have a quiet dream, and when I do, I feel so rested. Like the other night when I dreamt I served a customer uncooked turkey, but he ate it anyway. Can you suggest something to help? I'm getting so tired of my extra night shifts."
Uncooked turkey.
Yeah. It made her feel good that he ate it anyway.
Here's some raw turkey. And the customer goes, sure, it's yummy.
All customers ought to be this right. accommodating.
Right. No matter what you give them, you're able to eat that. I can just imagine.
Yeah.
Well, these are a group of things called parasomnias. Mm-hmm. That's the overall term. They can be caused by certain drugs. Lipitor and all statin drugs can actually cause this. So you want to look and see if there's a drug that's doing it. Sometimes you actually have to go on medications for it. A drug called gabapentin, which we use, changes the sleep architecture. That can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And sometimes a change in sleep hygiene can make a difference too. And we're going to put information on sleep hygiene on our website, zorbapastor.org. Beyond that, those are some things that may work. And beyond that, the real issue is, why aren't you serving your customers good, nutritious food when having your dreams?
Do you dream of stumping Zorba? Just send your stories along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
An interesting topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls. Our medical myth buster, of course. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up, but before that, after that awful tragedy in Connecticut, talk for the next couple of minutes about anxiety and kids.
Yeah, you know, it's such a big issue. We have this monstrous situation that occurred in Connecticut. And, of course, children suffer from anxiety. Most of the anxiety they suffer from is in their imagination. Monsters in the closets and so on. And it's really separation anxiety, strange noises, dark rooms. We've all had them, and it's sort of, you know, part of childhood growing up. But but you look at what's going on, and some of that anxiety, you know, is just unbelievable. I think there's some interesting things here. I think there's a time, if you have children in your house, where you actually shut off the television set, you shut off the news, you know, looking at the news. If you've got children in the house and the children are watching the news for this real-to-life situation, which is so scary, I think it's a bad time to actually, you know, do that. I think it's an important time to talk to your children, but it's bad to actually watch what's going on, of which they have no power, of course, to control.
Yeah. But other than turning off the television.
Well, there are other things you can do. You know, fairy tales are wonderful ways to discuss anxiety with your children. Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, you know, the kids win in fairy tales. And I don't mean the Berenstain Bears. I have four children, and we did a lot of the Berenstain Bears. But Bruno Bettelheim wrote a wonderful book a number of years ago, probably 30 years ago now, called Tales of Enchantment. And in that book, he explained the importance of fairy tales in a child's development and their ability to understand separation, things that they can't control, but in fact they can possibly get out of. And I think going through things like that can be very, very useful for a child who is anxious.
You tell kids this isn't going to happen to you.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the chances that it's going to happen to them are very minimal. Now, it could. The numbers are small, but it's a possibility. Yeah. The other issue is that if your child is anxious, seeking help through your physician, through a counselor at school can be very, very useful, because anxiety then, you know, is what many, many children can then suffer from, especially looking at this monstrous situation.
Yeah. And, of course, the anxiety being felt by the classmates of those kids.
Absolutely. And the parents, you know, as a parent of four children, I cannot imagine what the parents are going through. I mean, I can imagine, but I really can't. It's just it's a situation that is so awful.
Yeah.
What I think I'd like to sort of leave this situation with is the fact that there is help. Mental health professionals are out there talking to relatives, discussing things with your children, making sure that they're safe at night, telling them that they're safe at night can all make a difference, because our children are suffering from anxiety from this terrible situation, and we can help them.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, listener with us now in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Someone very close to me has been taking sleeping pills in order to get to sleep, and has prescriptions for two different kinds of sleeping pills. And I heard that even though your tolerance may go up, the level at which an overdose may occur does not go up. So I'm concerned as this person is taking increasingly more and more sleeping pills.
He or she is taking two different ones at the same time?
That's correct. One's Ambien, and she says it's a low dose. She says it's 5 milligrams, and the other one is Temazepam. She says that that one's also a low dose, but I don't know how many milligrams.
Uh-huh. So you obviously know this person fairly well, if you know what sleeping pills she's taking, right?
Well, she's just willing to answer questions, yeah.
Yeah, willing to answer. You know, these drugs are basically in a very similar class. Temazepam is called a benzodiazepine, closely related to other benzos in the field like Valium, Ativan, Xanax. These are drugs that are in a very similar field. Ambien is in a very similar class to that. And I kind of wonder why you're taking two pills. You're right, by the way, about the overdose level. That doesn't change at all. You know, it doesn't change what the tolerance level. And Ambien comes in 5 and 10 milligrams. Temazepam comes in a couple of milligrams. So mixing them together, I doubt if she's going to overdose on it. But the real question is, why is she doing it? That's really the bottom line. Does she find one doesn't put her to sleep, so she needs two? It's kind of a, seems to me to not be a common way, almost a goofy way of trying to get to sleep.
Yeah, she'll take a couple and then lie there and be unable to get to sleep for an hour and get up and take a third one.
Oh, so she's taking like three pills. That is not a good idea. I think I would come down squarely and say that is a bad idea. Is your friend an anxious person?
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, she has been told that she has anxiety.
Depressed? Is she depressed too or not depressed?
I wouldn't say so, but it's possible.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that are involved here. I mean, if we look at insomnia broadly, one of the things we want to do is we'll see if there's an underlying psychological problem. Is there anxiety or depression? Antidepressants used in the right way can really help you sleep. And in fact, there is an antidepressant called trazodone, T-R-A-Z-O-D-O-N-E, very effective as a sleeping pill. And I give it in small doses for people to get them to sleep. It's not habit forming. It doesn't really work as an antidepressant in those small doses, 25 milligrams or 10 milligrams. That can really help her a lot. That's one thing to look at. The other thing to look at is there are other pills such as gabapentin, G-A-B-A-pentin, P-E-N-T-I-N. And that's a drug that's used for seizures, chronic pain, and for sleep. Very effective drug. Sometimes that's used with and without a sleeping pill. But I think overall, she really needs to have a discussion with her doc. There's something we call sleep hygiene, looking at how you're sleeping, what the bed's like, what the pillow is like. You can do an inventory to see if things are right. But taking two drugs in this class, not getting sleep, getting up and taking a third drug, that's a bad idea. And these drugs kind of inebriate you a little bit. So you may get up in the middle of the night and take a second pill when in fact you don't realize you already took a second pill and this is a third pill. So my advice to her is she needs to have a consultation with her doctor and get this in.
Well, I'm wondering about a doctor who would prescribe all this stuff.
Good question. That's a good question. Is she going to one doc or two docs?
It could be two different doctors.
You see, now
I'm gaming the system.
Well,
that's not ever a wise
decision. That is never a wise decision. I have to tell you, I had a patient a number of years ago, and she came to me about once every 6 months with migraine headaches, and she'd asked for some oxycodone, and I knew her quite well because she was one of my referring doctors who I referred to. It was his wife, and she said, you know, the doctors in our clinic don't understand me, so I'd like to come to you. And she only came to me twice a year. This is years ago. And then one day the pharmacist called me up and he said, you know, I see this prescription. Do you know that she's getting this from five other doctors? Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I didn't know that. And he said, well, she is. Oh. And wow, that was exactly it. So if she's going to two doctors to get two sleeping pills, she's got to go to one doctor. There are a lot of other issues here, obviously.
Let me ask you something. You mentioned sleep hygiene. Is there like a checklist?
Sure. Actually, we'll put it on our website, zorbapastor.org. We'll do that on the web, and you come to our website, and we'll have that link for you.
Okay, super.
Take care. Thank you so much for your call.
All right, thanks very much, guys.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number, Medical Myth Buster Time now, Zorba. And today we're going to be talking about grapefruit and grapefruit juice. When you and I were kids, this was a really, really healthy thing, grapefruit juice,
right.
Really healthy. Right. Then we started to hear, well, not that long ago, about interaction with drugs.
Right.
And so
right.
The question now is, how healthy or not healthy is grapefruit?
Well, grapefruit juice is healthy, and I bet the reason that when we were kids they were talking about how healthy grapefruit juice was, it had a tangy sort of sour taste. And my guess is it was just being introduced because it's actually a fairly new hybridized fruit. But it turns out that grapefruit juice actually inhibits an enzyme called 3YP34A.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be on the test time, so you have to memorize it. CYP34A. And there are a whole bunch of medications. And when this first came out a fairly good number of years ago, we thought it was just a medication called Plendil, which is a type of anti-hypertensive medication. Now we're finding like there are 30, 40, 50 different medications that are altered by a grapefruit juice. And the question is, how much grapefruit juice should it be taken with these medications? And so there are a couple of things I tell my patient. Number one, I can't keep track of the drugs. Pharmacists do a great job of keeping track of the drugs because they push a button and it'll say, do not take with grapefruit juice. My recommendation to patients is do not take any of your medications with grapefruit juice, period. But it turns out if you drink lots and lots of grapefruit juice during the day and it's in your small intestine at the same time, it won't make a difference if you take it with your medicine. It's too much grapefruit juice. So when you go to the pharmacist and you're getting your medication, what you want to do is say, how much grapefruit juice can I drink with this medicine? And the pharmacist will give you an answer based on the best data that we have.
Yeah, but we keep on adding new medicines.
Right. Well, I say to patients, do not take your medicines with grapefruit juice. Make it simple. The real question is, can you drink grapefruit juice at other times during the day, 2 hours after you take your pills? It's really when you take your pills and they're being metabolized and they're going into the body. And the answer for a lot of it is you can drink 6 ounces once or twice a day, but you can't drink 3 or 4 glasses if you're on any of the pills that
are
listed.
My favorite juice, I don't drink
it. It is?
I don't drink it anymore.
Oh, I can tell. I didn't realize. I didn't realize this was something that was close to your heart.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
How much grapefruit juice do you drink?
Well, I don't drink any.
Oh, you stopped drinking because of this?
Yeah.
Oh, I feel so sorry for you.
I'll get over it. I'll live. Because I'm not drinking that grapefruit juice.
Right, exactly.
Do you have a myth for Zorba the juice? Just send it along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener with us in Guthrie, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
I was wondering, according to my doctor, I'm considered obese. So is my mom and dad. But nobody on either side of the family has any kind of medical problems. Nobody's diabetic. Nobody has high blood pressure. Nobody has high cholesterol. We're all just fine. And I was wondering, is it like genetic or something that why we're all healthy?
Yeah, can I just ask you the ages of all the people you mentioned?
I'm 43. My dad is 65 and my mom is 68.
So you mean, is there a genetic component to the fact that you're healthy even though you're obese? Yes.
Right.
Yes. Well, there's no doubt about that. There's definitely a genetic component. There are people who are obese who, you know, live long lives. You can see there are old people who walk around who are really heavy and they live, and there are young people who are really thin who die. And cardiac disease, which is really the main issue, because cancer and obesity do not link together. There's no linkage that I know of that is credible. But if we look at cardiac, you know, people who have very little cardiac history in their family, they've got a good cholesterol. I mean, I have people who weigh 300 pounds and their cholesterol is like 180. And they go, really, I eat everything I can, and how come my cholesterol is so low? And the answer is genetics that you have, and that's why you're good. So the answer is yes. Now, what sort of problems will you have with obesity? Well, we know obesity still makes it more likely you're going to develop diabetes. We know diabetes is on the rise. There's more diabetes today than there ever was before. There are many people who do not have diabetes in their family, and obesity produces it. There's no doubt about that. We know heart disease and arthritis are much more likely to occur with people with obesity. So it's not exactly a pass. It's not a hall pass to eat. But the reality is, yes, you can be overweight and be healthy. So let me ask some questions. In your family, go back one generation to grandparents. How old do they live?
My grandmother, she passed away, and it's on my mom's side, at 59. She did die of a heart attack. And my grandfather, which her husband, was 89.
Okay, 89.
They were in Ukraine during the war. They both got rheumatic fever, and they both had heart problems because of the rheumatic fever.
And they were in the war, so they were in egregious circumstances. You know, where they didn't have enough protein and calories in the middle. It's really a different issue, so we can't tell much from that at all.
Right.
You know, so once again, it's the reality is you can be overweight and be healthy, and obesity is not as much of a risk factor for sudden death from heart attacks as smoking, and we know smokers are thinner and they die of more heart disease. So generally, smoking reduces about 10 years from your life, and obesity does not necessarily reduce 10 years from your life. So that's where it's at. Now, what's interesting is that I find it difficult as a doctor giving you a hall pass for obesity. I'm sitting here thinking,
I understand. And every doctor I see, especially if it's a new doctor, and they look at you and you're going, no, I don't have high blood pressure. They look at you like, yeah, whatever. Let me do all these tests and find out first because I don't believe you. And when it all comes back fine, they look at you like, well, okay.
Well,
know?
No, no. But
what else can I say to you, you know? But in general, I do need to lose weight. I know that.
It's interesting because we are taught as physicians that obesity is bad. We see it when you walk in the office. And so we then look for all the things that make it bad, like you say. What's wrong with your body biochemically? And when everything is right, we scratch our head and we go, well, maybe in your case, obesity isn't bad, but we can't get that out of our mouth. You know, it's not possible.
Yeah. I understand.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Before we head out for the day, Zorba, let's share a quick note from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health voicemail box. This little tip comes to us from Linda in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who's found an illuminating solution to a common problem. And even better, Zorba, she agrees with your advice. Linda says, I heard a caller on your show who thought that she needed to gain weight to stay warm in the winter. But Dr. Zorba was absolutely right. Gaining weight does not make you warmer. I did find one way to stay warm in the office, though. I use a reptile heating lamp. I put one above my desk so it shines on my keyboard and keeps my hands toasty. It works great.
It's very, very interesting. So never thought about that. If your hands are really cold, shine a warm light, some sort of an infrared light or something else on the keyboard so your hands
luckily,
will be just
fine.
Luckily,
we all have reptile lamps.
Yeah. Reptile lamps. That's right. I can just picture that. I've seen reptile
lamps. The poor
lamps,
lizard will not feel so good when you take his light away. Anyway, have an issue you'd like to shed some light on, just send your advice along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next time, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can also find us on Facebook.
And you can call us anytime, too, at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1222Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.